I'd like to be able to introduce David Stokes, the first speaker for this morning, and looking for your talk, David.
Good morning, everybody. So my job is to give you an introduction to membrane proteins and also to 2D crystallography. Nigel's going to talk about helical things, so I'll mention those, but not talk very much, and also single particles. You know, I was given topics and questions and such, which you can read about, but rather than explicitly address these, I've decided to take a more sort of artistic approach, such as you would expect from a novelist or an artist or a movie producer, where there definitely were questions that I was trying to address in my presentation, but they don't like write down their questions in the front of a novel. They expect the reader to kind of try to figure out what were the questions and to think about the answers for themselves. So I'm sure you'll be able to do that. So this is an outline of my talk. They're not all equally weighted, but we talk with a little, start with a little history, and then talk about membranes and membrane proteins, and then talk quite a lot about structure determination methods and 2D crystallization, and particularly some high throughput screening methods that we've been developing to try to catch up with this JCMIT people, and then types of 2D crystals that result, and some software and the types of development that we might want to think about doing if we really want to progress in this area. So I'll start with this inspiration that I had when I was preparing for the talk. I stumbled on this article that Tom wrote, and we're indeed trying to do a revival. I was a bit surprised at this title because Tom is not the most enthusiastic, optimistic person always when I talk to him, and so to have such an enthusiastic title I thought was a very good sign. And so he points out here a couple of the advantages of 2D crystallography. You can't read this, but one of the main advantages of electron crystallography is that you're looking at membrane proteins in a native lipid bilayer, and that's a big advantage that we shouldn't underestimate compared to X-ray crystallographers and most of single particle applications where you're looking at things in detergent micelles. I'll talk more about that. And so Tom talks here about a game of numbers. And his point over here is that there's been great progress in X-ray crystallography over the last 10 years. And some of you will know Danang Wang, who is one of the early people who was involved in the atomic structure solution of LHC. And Danang has turned to the X-ray crystallography completely. He has a brand new structure coming out. And so that's great. But there's been tremendous progress with the X-ray crystallography. And what's left on the electron crystallography side is just, what does he say, a couple of dozen groups that are working on this. So we're really a very small group, and we need to increase our activities. So what do the numbers look like? This is a table. I'm sure that there's probably some people I left out. If you're here, I'm sorry. There's always leaving out people when you're making a list. But these are supposed to represent the different structures, some of the different structures that have been produced by electron crystallography. At the top, the ones in boldface are structures that resulted in atomic traces of the chain, peptide chain. And then there's a whole slew of them that are at our sort of intermediate resolution, that where you can see alpha helices that are the most prevalent structure crossing the membrane. There's a lot of repetition here. There's a lot of bacteria rhodopsin, which was, of course, the first protein that was addressed with these methods. There's quite a lot of aquaporins, which is at the top of the list with Tom Walters and Tamir Gonen's 1.9 angstrom structure. Then there's this is the Dunning and Werner Kulbrand's work of light harvesting complex. Acetylcholine receptor you're going to hear about in the next talk from Nigel. And so these groups also are repeated down here, BR, and there's a lot of rhodopsin and aquaporins, but there's quite a lot of others. This is from our work, the calcium ATPase and gap junctions and transporters and multi-drug transporters and all sorts of things. So, this is a widely applicable technique. We've had success, which has come from a very small number of groups concentrating on just a few proteins, but I think if we expand our operations, then it will be more broadly applicable. I resorted this list to do it chronologically so you can kind of, since this is a history lesson, see where we started. So back in the early days was Nigel and Richard's really groundbreaking work on bacteria rhodopsin. published first in 1975. And so that took 15 years of methods development, basically, to get from the first structure at 7 angstrom resolution to the 3.5 angstrom atomic structure in 1990, which was then refined further from Yoshi Fujiyoshi's group up to 3 angstroms, and I guess Nico was involved in this work also. But these atomic structures keep periodically appearing as time goes by, and it's the latest one. Well, the latest one is just this year. There's a structure of aquaporin 4, again from Yoshi Fujiyoshi's group. So I think it was Alistair Stephen was referring to when he was, the three blind mice brought him back to his early days. So this is what I think of as my nursery rhymes. The early days was this first structure of bacteria rhodopsin. And this is the one of the images that was in this paper from 1975. Before we had a lot of computer graphics, we used balsa wood and stacked things up. So these are the 7 transmembrane helices representing the 7 angstrom structure of bacteria rhodopsin. And then a couple of years ago, this is the 1.9 angstrom structure of aquaporin. And what we have here is, in this case, this was not a single layer of crystal. This was a double-layered crystal. So this is one lipid bilayer here. This is one leaflet. This is the other leaflet. And this is the second lipid bilayer in these two leaflets. And what was extraordinary about this 1.9 angstrom structure was that not only did you see the protein, which is all the blue densities here of the aquaporin, but you also saw every single lipid molecule that was in this bilayer. So these are, in fact, the lipid tails of the lipids, the hydrophobic tails of the lipids, which are in
96 wells. You put them all together onto one grid, and then you look at it in the microscope. If you find one crystal, then you can narrow down screening and go back to the conditions.
So you want to put multiple conditions. You found the good stuff.
So David, I got a question for you. So you acknowledge the New York comps that you're working with. One of the things that we've seen from the Protein Structure Initiative is NMR and crystallography have really started working together. I mean, now the samples automatically get sent to NMR, they get pre-screened, and then if they're best by NMR, they go to NMR. If they're best by crystallography, they go that path. Could you say something about how EM and sort of New York comps has sort of tried integrating better with crystallography? And somewhat of a sort of, you know, entry point into this question is NMR, in fact, the real beauty of NMR is dynamics. So, in fact, it's sometimes faster just to solve the structure by crystallography, and then you get dynamic information from the NMR. EM, what I love about EM, particularly for membrane proteins, is it's the only technique where you can actually see the real image, you know, what's really sort of the real environment. Crystallography, NMR, we're in artificial environments. And so it seems like heterogeneity is actually a good thing to sort of see from EM, and use that information to combine with crystallography or an NMR. So I'm just curious your thoughts on how better to integrate the techniques.
Well, the heterogeneity, you would need to look at non-crystalline. Informational synergies.
And I think that's exactly right. That, you know, with NMR used to be sort of a competition with crystallography. You know, Kurt Wuthrich used to give these lectures on the evils of crystallography, and he doesn't do that anymore. In fact, you know, we collaborate very closely with him on this. But it seems like with EM crystallography, as you sort of started out your talk about how to sort of keep up, there's just beautiful complementation between the techniques, and so it's really complementation, it's not a in competition.
No, yeah, just a comment along those lines. I think where it could make a really useful addition is that if you look back into the history, everything that made a 2D crystal later on was also crystallized in 3D. So there's this paradigm that pre-screening for 2D crystallizability actually is an excellent indicator whether you should actually try to go into 3D. And that may not make so much sense for bacterial membrane protein, where you can easily take just, you know, 100 different species and then do your thing. But where it's interesting and why I think also the structure centers are stuffed up on, right, is the mammalian membrane proteins that are much less stable. And, you know, there you now have the choice that you say, do you go in and do the mutagenesis stabilization by creating 500 mutants of the membrane protein to see if you can stabilize it and now get to a crystal state, or do you just pump it through a 2D crystallization screen and pick the ones where you know, okay, those will be the mammalian membrane.
One question over here.
In the beginning of your talk, you showed a new method that you're attaching a protein to a lipid membrane, a particular lipid membrane, and you subtract the density of the lipid to get the protein.
want to answer?
Yeah, so it's the best thing that we've thought of is to add the lipid back in. So in our reconstruction process, we know the orientation and position of each protein particle. We know what lipid model we subtracted, so we can construct a model of a patch of membrane and add it back in there. And then we're in the same situation as 2D crystal.
Time for one more question.
Just to the draw system I have in attitude. You have one problem in scaling 2D crystals. Well, a major problem in 2D crystallography is that once you have very good crystals, data collection is a major problem too. So are there any efforts to try to make the specimens more reproducible, that we can really collect data, make it more flat, get it not dried out?
Grid preparation, you mean? There's posters out here about different substrates to use. So,
quick question.
Just to follow up on that, one of the next things that Henning Stahlberg is working on, and I don't know how actively they're working on it, but they're starting to look at variation in the images of the 2D crystals and starting to apply all the multivariate statistical approaches to individual unit cells or patches of unit cells, sort of in an attempt to try and figure out why certain things don't work as well as they ought to. Can you show disordered regions, or can you really prove you've got little tilted areas and things like that? So there is some work being done along those lines.
So that's not specimen preparation, that's post-processing.
Not specimen preparation, but it's addressing the issue of why do all these structures, you know, seem to not behave as well as you'd like.
And one could use that to improve the resolution as well,
exactly.
A more sophisticated and unbending approach.
Exactly.
All right. I want to thank Clint and Bridget again for having this session on membrane proteins starting off this morning, and thank David for a great introductory talk.